This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
With government repression isolated the movement so much that it was seeming to become more ineffective and reinventing the wheel quite a bit. So we wanted to begin a dialogue and a discourse around what types of things and perspectives, what kind of novel ideas can be brought to the table in order to build a movement that would kind of build itself out of the isolation that had been more or less characterizing things recently.
Well, I think that's part of what was really important to me is that you wouldn't necessarily see social justice organizations and animal rights organizations in the same ballpark. In the past, you wouldn't have seen unions and environmental organizations together, but at the action in Seattle against the World Trade Conference, you did. You saw the first time, 50,000 union people come together marching with people carrying signs with whales on them. It was a very important step, and yet there's been a lot that's happened in the past 10 years or 11 years since then. I want to go to Josh. Josh, fill us in, because you've been personally one of the targets of this. The context in the nation around animal rights advocacy, there's the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, is that what it's called? I don't have it in front of me here, but there's been special laws developed just to go after animal rights advocates, and they're pushing new ones every day. And the repression has been pretty hard. Can you kind of set the context of this conference in that?
Absolutely. I think one thing that people really need to consider when they think about politics in the United States is that on average, you can pick the winner of an election 9 out of 10 times just by seeing how much money they have spent. And obviously, this money has to come from somewhere. In the United States, the biggest lobbyists are, number one, the pharmaceutical industry, and that's followed by guns and tobacco. And these are all industries.
Boy, that does sound like America.
These are all industries, though, that have a vested interest in the continuation of the oppression of animals and in the model of animal use that basically sees them as biological machines for, human fulfillment. And so basically what's been happening in the United States is that these lobbying interests have been introducing legislation to protect them from animal rights activism, even if that activism is only speech. They always bill this legislation as, anti-terrorism legislation. But when you look at what it prohibits basically independent media. When they came after us, they came after us for a website and for a newsletter. Another thing that they're seeking to do is they want to make sure that we can't spread what they are doing. There's been a series of laws lately that have been being passed on the state level, which are referred to as ag-gag laws, where they don't want to allow people to take undercover footage and show that to the public.
I think there's 6 states that are about to pass laws like that, and there were several that passed them last year. They make it literally a felony to they make it a felony in some of the states even to apply for a job at an agricultural enterprise and not tell them if you're a member of an animal rights organization. You must disclose any past involvement with it, which is those laws shouldn't make it through our Constitution, but then we don't have guardians of the old Constitution in a lot of courts right now anyway.
Right. I think that it's telling that on every level, they want to shut us up. And they're using their financial power in order to do that. And the more we began looking at things, the more we began seeing who our opponents were, we realized they weren't just our opponents. Basically, all of our movements share enemies, and those enemies wear suits and ties and badges and guns. And yet we direct all this energy at criticizing each other and distancing ourselves from each other. And it's time to end that.
Wow, that's a pretty powerful statement. I noticed that in the people that are sponsoring this this conference, you do have a real diversity of people. You have people like you speaking, and you have, but you also have speakers from the Oregon Jericho, which is a local grassroots organization based here in Portland that's been fighting for human rights and works with prisoners as they come out of prison. You also have people who are experts in race and gender politics and in understanding the difficulty of intersections between people who are working around racial politics or are working around gender politics and other what appear to be single issue causes like animal rights. And so at this conference, you intend to really take on these issues directly.
Absolutely. And it's been a failing of our movement for many years that we've refused to look at these things. And we've suffered the consequences. I mean, we are continuously plagued by not having any new blood. And when you look around at the membership that we do have, it's primarily white. It's primarily middle class. And all of these things are limiting. It means that our perspectives are never broad enough to fully recognize what means might be available to us to take down our opponents and to progress to progress our politics in the
world.
And
to jointly learn from each other's struggles. I think that, you know, for example, in slaughterhouses, it's one of the least safe jobs in the world, and it's predominantly Hispanic in a lot of areas in the United States, and it's deathly hard work. And you will see people working in that field act cruelly to animals. They're put in a situation where they see the animals as something completely separate from their own humanity or their own place on the planet. And that could end up pitting the workers' rights on these, you know, slaughterhouses against the animal rights people who feel like, look, you're an enemy. But we have to recognize that in both of these cases, nobody's benefiting. That worker is suffering and could be educated. And the opportunity to educate them isn't here if we don't reach out and recognize that they're not our enemy, that they're actually someone suffering under the same large corporate oligarchy that runs this nation, or maybe it's a global or oligarchy would be better to say it.
Lauren Ornelas.
This is Tim speaking, Tim Hitchens.
Hi. Lauren Ornelas actually is going to be tackling that issue head on.
Talk about her, who she is.
Lauren is also a longtime animal rights activist who kind of has the same sentiment of us sitting here in this room about the importance of intersectionality and understanding that it's not just quite, you know, going vegan for the animals, but understanding farm worker practices, the slaughterhouse practices, understanding, you know, where your chocolate comes from, where all the products that you're buying come from. It's not just seeing the label as being read as this is vegan, I should buy it. She'll be tackling that issue in one of our.
Well, and I think that's important because a lot of people think of veganism as not a political choice. Maybe almost more like a fashion choice or a food preference choice, and have the discussion deeply and be able to walk away not necessarily having convinced the others, but still close, saying, but we're united on this. That'll be important. Those are important kinds of conversations. And really, here in Portland, we've sort of got a hotbed of all sides of this, I believe. So how did the resistance ecology movement begin? What got you guys together? And how do you hope that in having this conference here, you will form new ways of organizing? Or are you already forming that new way of organizing?
I touched on this a little bit in the beginning. So,
and this is Justin Kay.
So our work with doing local grassroots stuff in Portland with the Animal Defense League and we had also worked kind of try to do some foundational work for building networks in the Northwest and the West Coast with groups from Vancouver, BC, down through California. We had worked with the Seattle Animal Defense League, things of that nature as well. And we that coupled with our experience in town working with movements that were would most often be considered directly outside the perspective of animal rights.
PCASC
is a group.
Can you talk about who they are?
That's Portland Central America Solidarity Committee. Tim can speak to this as well. He's got pretty good relationships with people from PCASC. They are a group that does a lot of advocacy work for issues in Latin America.
Immigration issues.
The effects that globalization directed from politics the United States would have on communities in Latin America, indigenous communities, worker communities. And they also incorporate kind of a perspective of political ecology in that work as well. And there's members of that organization that are, had expressed interest in working with us on animal rights things. So we kind of got introduced to them more directly when we were doing stuff during Occupy Portland with
I was going to bring that up. So bring in Occupy here, because one of the most exciting things about Occupy was, one, it helped define who we are, who they are. We're the 99. They're the one. It's really worse than that, 99.9, and they're the 0.1, but nonetheless. And it also showed a new way of organizing. People wanted to call it crazy. They still do. They still say it wasn't organized, but there was organization that took place. And so talk about where Occupy fits in growing this up and in the conference itself.
Sure. This is Tim, by the way. Occupy Portland was actually kind of a catalyzing moment for us as animal rights activists. While Occupy Portland was going on, we were members of Portland Animal Defense League. We were definitely very active members and in all the days of actions and contributing as much as possible. And we realized how much our discussions about getting resistance ecology and intersectionality were important during Occupy Portland, even more so, particularly because, we would go out on marches or whatever, and there'd be chants like people over profits. And, for us, it was like, it's not just people. It's not just the 99% of people, but it's, in a statement, runs the 99.99% of all the biomass that exists in the entire globe.
And that's some statement of mine that I somewhat regret.
but
it's probably close to the truth.
And it kind of brought to light, that the animal rights movement and the environmental movement, but the animal rights movement in particular, is not viewed as part of the broader social justice movement the way that it should be. And fortunately, we were able to meet some really incredible people from, Rising Tide, PCASC, Oregon Jericho, people from We Are Oregon, all over across the board. And we were able to, form these relationships that we have been able to, years past now, really bring or call upon to continue growing this movement. I mean, what we hope is a much more organized fashion rather than just at point seemingly pointless marches here and there.
Specifically, we got involved on what they refer to as a spokes council called Portland Action Lab, and that was the kind of umbrella group that was really a collective coordinated effort of all of the kind of pre-existing radical organizations in town plugging into Occupy through their experience doing large-scale direct action organization. This is, it was a project of groups like PCASC and Rising Tide and Animal Defense League and Oregon Jericho, We Are Oregon, and there was a lot of union representation there as well. And it was this kind of like, we were having meetings with, easily over 30 people kind of coordinating efforts to do these large days of action in town, the first one being the N17 Day of Action Against Banks. And after that, Spokes Council itself organized the National Day of Action, F29, against corporations that were involved in ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council. And it was that I think was more so of a rather than just general involvement in Occupy Portland, it was that grouping of people in organizations that kind of shed light on like what really makes up the quote-unquote 99%, like what within that large chunk of the population that is disadvantaged through our political and power systems, what within that are the the marginalized communities, and how are the voices there balanced or unbalanced? And like, it was really those conversations, and we'd had pre-existing relationships with a lot of those groups already, but it was there that we really began to kind of nourish kind of that perspective of what it means to be a part of the larger perspective of social justice and liberatory politics. And we wanted to be able to incorporate the whole idea of animal liberation and radical ecology to be kind of synonymous with social justice, as opposed to just like this addendum, so to speak.
And I think what you're talking about, these moments when it probably was a little different moments for some of the other members of the resistance ecology, when you're sitting around a table and you realize, wow, these are the right people in a certain way. We've actually got the beginning of something here. I can feel it, and it's new and it's important. And I do feel like, despite all of what the mass media wants to say, and despite that it's true that a large chunk of what Occupy was got stopped, and we can learn really well through the released documents that organizations are putting out there on the web about how they went about doing that. But the other thing that it revealed was that they use the same tactics. They're organized. They have a fusion center out on the Clackamas County Community College Center, where all of the different police and government agencies of that sort, law enforcement agencies at all levels, fuse their information together. It is so important that we don't be so behind the gun that they're more organized in their attempts to get every one of us and keep every one of us separate. Whatever your passionate cause is that's part of this country and throwing off the blanket of oppression that it is, we have to be able to fuse. Mm-hmm. We have to be able to fuse. And so you're saying that in some of those actions as well, some of those direct actions were new ways of doing things.
It was really empowering the way that we would be essentially working with our peers and colleagues from other components of the radical movements. And it would make us kind of, you know, make sure that the organizing we were doing as affinity groups on the Spokes Council, that we would be pulling off the best actions the smartest way. It kind of made us really rethink and made us be much better at being activists together, because we were all trying to, you know, be a part of this broader movement. It was really awesome. Some pretty amazing actions took place in this city.
Really upped your game, in other words. So.
Yeah.
I mean, those are some of the best organizers that we've ever worked with. I mean, they weren't even part of the animal rights movement prior to meeting us at all. It was mostly just, I think that's kind of something that people often forget too, is being able to who you work with kind of like synergistically. And a lot of the time, I mean, we found that outside of just the animal rights perspective, just the animal rights issue. And it was being able to like work with people like that and learn from other people. Movements that have done a better job at maintaining a multi-generational representation within their groups and things of that nature, that we were able to kind of like up our game, quote unquote, being able to realize like what we weren't bringing to the table that they were, and what could we do to kind of match that at least, and be able to kind of like bounce off ideas off each other and learn from each other.
So at this conference, one of the things you're going to do is you're going to look back at this most recent movement, but you're going to look back at the last decade or a little bit further, mm-hmm. and say, how was it that we got picked off? We know more now from inside the government, literally, because of our articles that have been released with memos, how they went about it. But you also know more from what's happened. And marginalization is one of the main tactics, and that's one of the things that you guys have said. You've used that term, and that, I believe, is why they were able to go after the Black Panthers. Mm-hmm. They were able to marginalize them, and because African Americans are marginalized within the overall oppressive culture anyway, they were able to do that. And I think animal rights activists were able to be picked off because they were seen as so separate. They were seen as these young people, and to some degree doing silly acts. I'll be honest, you know, as an old activism, when someone burns an SUV, I just am going, are you kidding? It just didn't move me to want to join the organization, even though I shared some of the same rights. I mean, some of the same attitudes, mm-hmm. about animal rights, and share many of them. So you guys are going to go back and look at what worked, what went wrong. How was it that they were able to infiltrate us so well? Is that one of the issues you guys are going to be looking at? And are you going to be dealing with and talk about infiltration? Or how did they pick people off, mm-hmm. that then testified against us if it wasn't infiltration to start with? Some of those issues kids, I think, are really, really important. And at the same time, there are bound to be feds at this conference. You know, I mean, we're all laughing. Of course they're going to be. They even admit it. They pay a lot of money to people to go there. So do you want to talk about how you're going to look at this last decade and what you hope to learn from it?
Sure.
And this is Josh Harper, I'm asking.
There's a lot to answer there. One, you're right. They had an easier time taking down the more successful elements of our movement because we were so marginalized. When the FBI was following us, when Joint Terrorism Task Forces were raiding our homes, when our phones were tapped and our emails were being read, when it came out that some of my best friends were paid informants, you know, who had been paid up to $70,000 a year to befriend and spy upon me. We didn't have a whole lot of people shouting about it.
No, I remember, and that's, you're right. We allowed, to that extent, the rest of the left allowed ourselves to not pay attention.
But part of that was the fault of our own movement. For years, we had tolerated sexist and racist campaigns coming from animal rights national organizations such as PETA, and we had never done a whole heck of a lot to reach out to other organizations. On occasion, when we did, though, we learned so much, and it's a shame that we didn't see sooner the value of those coalitions. We've talked a lot about coalitions today, and I think that one thing that gets ignored about coalition building is that the state has already shown us that they consider it a threat. When you think about the murder of Fred Hampton Sr., for example, what a lot of people don't know is that was precipitated by him building coalitions with Puerto Rican independence movement folks and also with poor whites who were being displaced from the Appalachian mountain range by mechanized textile factories and coal mining.
And for those of you that don't remember who Fred Hampton is, he was a leader within the Black Panther movement. I believe he was in Chicago.
Correct.
Is where they shot him in his bed. There was a line of thousands of people who came by his apartment that day. The bullets all went in through his door, and he was shot in his bed. And this is why Mumia is in jail as well, is because Mumia was a coalition builder and had a voice that went much farther, and that's Mumia Abu-Jamal from Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So continue.
And we can continue going with this whole thing. Martin Luther King's assassination was preceded by him announcing the Poor People's Movement and by beginning to say, this goes bigger than civil rights. This touches on capitalism. This touches on all of our lives. And we're beginning to say that this goes beyond animal rights. This goes beyond ecology. This is about the entire biological community, humans, and most especially oppressed humans, and oppressed animals and ecosystems that are under the chainsaw.
And those ecosystems are almost always in the areas where indigenous people are living.
It's true.
And so you really can't escape the unity that we have.
Mm-hmm. There's intersectionality everywhere.
And so talk about that word. We've got like 3 minutes. So talk about some key words that are going to be heard there. Intersectionality. What do you mean by that?
I guess I'll go on that one. Intersectionality. I mean, I should flag that term was really popularized by Angela Davis, who's was a prominent member of the Black Power movement in the 70s and 60s, and is still a really active voice for the concept of intersectionality.
And a former member of the Communist Party.
Yeah, former member of the Communist Party. And she, you know, faced her own wave of repression. We won't get into, obviously, we can look up the history. But
intersectionality.
Yes, intersectionality. I mean, she kind of spoke to that as conceptually as dealing with kind of what it means to be more than just a woman or more than just a black person, but the idea that you can be both and how those things relate and how we move, like, for instance, the Black Power movement, it's at the time wasn't dealing well with the intersections of being not just black. I mean, how do we deal with not just being concerned about animal rights? How do we relate that issue to people that have other priorities, that are dealing with gentrification in their communities, or they don't have access to organic or vegan food the same way that our middle class white community that primarily makes up the animal rights movement does? And how do we kind of speak to those politics in a way that addresses the intersections that they have, you know, either intersections that we have as movements in our common enemy or the intersections that occur within the power structures that we are opposing. I mean, an obvious one is addressing capitalism, which is one of the primary.
Or look at ALEC. You know,
ALEC,
that organization has been important in helping the banks get over on people, and they're the organization that goes around and proposes legislation that fits the conservatives or the oligarchy's needs.
And so
part of it is opposing those. I believe we're out of time. I hate this, guys. You know, we're right at the end of it. This is Resistance Ecology Conference. It starts May 31st. It's going to go through June 2nd. It's got a really great flyer that you can download from the website. So you'll want to go to the website. It's conference.resistanceecology.org. It's just like it's spelled, conference.resistanceecology.org. And you can also just Google Resistance Ecology. Thank you so much for joining me, Josh Harper, Tim Hitchens, and Justin Kay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for being part of organizing an important conference as we go forward trying to figure out how to build our strengths and overcome the oppression of our oligarchy.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us here on KBOO. And for all of you listeners, please stay tuned for more of Political Perspectives. I believe we have Chris Andre and Air Cascadia up next.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Chris Andre is up next with Air Cascadia, and then at 10:15, Flashpoints features a new talk and reading by one of Latin America's most celebrated writers, Eduardo Galeano. And activists Daryl Cherney and Mike Rosal talk about new information about who bombed Judy Berry. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Sarika Mehta interviews Jean Kwok, author of the award-winning novel Girl in Translation. And at 11:30, the film show features news and interviews about the independent film scene in Portland. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
Good morning, Pee-wee.
Good morning, Mr. Breakfast.
Start your morning right and come celebrate 45 years with the Fruits, Nuts, and Flakes at the first ever Breakfast with the Boo, Saturday, June 1st, 9 a.m. to noon. There'll be live music, pancake flipping, bluegrass picking, and so much more. That's Saturday, June 1st, 9 a.m. to noon at the Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 Northeast Knott Street. More information can be found at kboo.fm.
Bisquick, 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 pancake, 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 waffle. Bisquick, 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 pancake, pancake, pancake,
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, May 23rd, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Yesterday at PSU, the final stop on the Government Accountability Project's whistleblower tour, it took place. There were interesting questions from a number of very interesting members of the audience. Of course, Walter Tomasitis was there, and Tom Carpenter, both instrumental in shedding light on what is actually happening at Hanford. Another story emerged during the talk and the question and answer period. A woman brought up some critical points. There is actually a nuclear facility at Hanford that is operational. It is generating power. It has one of the worst safety records of any such operation in the whole country. It hadn't been inspected for 27 years. It was recently renewed with virtually no inspection for yet another 20 years. More on that later. We have some audio from that question and answer period. And actions are coming up this weekend. In the next few days, we'll see the Global Day of Action Against Monsanto. That it coincides, of course, with our own village building convergence. We're going to be speaking today with Mark Lakeman of the BBC, and also we will speak with Kevin Zeist to get an update on the Bradley Manning final pre-trial days. First, this from the National Weather Service. We have rain today, quite obviously, with a high around 55. A chilly day with wind, south wind 8 to 10. Tonight, the rain continues, temperatures dropping down into the high 40s, around 49. And it'll be breezy again, according to the National Weather Service, anyway, for tomorrow. Rain and a high near 60. It'll be breezy, 6 to 10 miles per hour for Friday night. For tomorrow night, rain possibly backing off a little bit. Again, it's still going to be cool. Lows around 49 and the wind dropping off. The alternative forecast, of course, it's a waxing gibbous root moon. The moon is 13 days old. And the advice from the Cynetic, the biodynamic, the sidereal farm voices is pretty much holding steady. So we'll get back to that when we are able to report more changes so far as the alternative forecast advice column. That's it for the conventional forecast and the alternative for today. We want to go straight to our first guest, Mark Lakeman, with City Repair, because the Village Building Convergence 2013 is upon us, this year's theme being succession. Perhaps one of the most interesting and complex, not complicated people, not complicated, but complex ideas to emerge from the permaculture movement, but also, of course, a concept that is increasingly being talked about in activist communities and people building intentional communities across the country. Good morning, Mark. Thank you so much for being with us. We're really glad to welcome you back to the KBOO airwaves.
Thanks, Chris. It's wonderful to be on the air with you.
Well, this is for me anyway. The idea of succession is very interesting, and some of the ways in which that the notion of the awareness of succession, the processes that we are talking about, that is.
Well, you and I were talking the other day about how in our present society, how the tendency for things to happen over time in cycles at best, but